very austere in the beginning. Very austere. When we used to go there and would stay in the wall. When we first went, we stayed in what the shops are now. That was all there was. That was before even the long building. And three by three, I mean yards or meters, and as many as could sleep on the floor side by side. And that's, there was mosquitoes, there was everything. And everyone got sick. Now it's...
They have the shower, the round shower house?
Yeah, they had this round shower house. Where Prabhupada Samadhi is now. And that area, around the shower house and toilets. And
we stayed on the roof when they built that square house, had the kitchen in the basement.
And it was. And Prabhupada had us do 24-hour kirtan then. When all the devotees were there, then in Vrindavan Mayapur, everyone had to take part in 24-hour kirtan.
Afterwards,
she was leaving, then some of the devotees asked him to do kirtan, so that kirtan, I think it's pretty famous, Namasvishtam, he sings that, and then he sings Shrita Pada Kamala, and then he sings Hare Krishna, just him playing the drum. That was there, that was again in the wall, one of the rooms. And he just, the devotee's just asking, can you lead kirtan? So then he sang kirtan for some time. And the way he played drum when he sang kirtan, he was singing and he would just go boom. That was sort of a style for a long time. And then he would wait and he would just go boom. And chant Hare Krishna. He would chant some Hare Krishna, and he would hit the drum like every 30 seconds, just a big head. When we went faster than when he went a little faster, but that's how we used to always sing Mangal Arti, is Undu Teeny Teeny or any sort of thing. We just hit the drum like that every once in a while, either on the beat or off beat. Just hit the big head and touch the small head. And I saw in Pavana Sarovar at Sanatana Goswami's Bhajan Kutir, where his samadhi is, where Krishnadas Babaji Maharaj's samadhi is. It's a Gaudiya temple, Gaudiya Math temple, and I forget what the name is of it. I don't remember. Once we went there to Pavana Sarovar, and he was chanting in the same way. Just actually, I went there with Nandanandan. I was sitting behind Prabhupada, hating to throw him on the telephone. I was just on the other side from the other entrance, from where they take prasadam. I was just sitting beside Prabhupada, but behind him, and someone walked in and offered Prabhupada a garland. He put it on Prabhupada. Prabhupada continued talking, and I could see this garland was swarming with ants. It was just crawling with ants. It was a marigold garland. And I was in such a dilemma. I didn't know, should I just interrupt Prabhupada and say, Prabhupada, there are ants? And ants started crawling on Prabhupada's kirtan. And then when they started going on his head, then Prabhupada took it off. But that was, I didn't want to disturb Prabhupada. But it was very interesting. It was rare that Prabhupada was, but the room was full. Prabhupada was giving darshan. That was his darshan time. And the devotees would come. Maybe it was full sometimes. It was just the impression was, I remember being there when it was. Festival was going on, and yet there weren't that many devotees. There.
one class in Homa that I was there, but he said, you know, he was talking about Courtney Shore, I believe him, who he said, we're willing to take any amount of criticism from our wife and family, children, but if the guru chastises us, then, you know, we'd be so offended and maybe even go away.
He was quoting Gaurav Shore's Babaji?
Yeah. But he said, he was, you know, elaborating.
Mm-hmm.
So then he said how there's, you know, there's bona fide guru and bona fide disciples, and then there's bogus guru and bona fide disciple, bogus guru, bogus disciple. You know, like, yeah, bogus disciple. So he did all the different combinations that there could be. So, like when Srila Prabhupada was here, he was training the leaders, but he didn't personally instruct, you know, us rank and file devotees, but he was training them, and we would take instruction from the temple authorities, whoever they may be. And but you know, now I wonder about gurus instructing disciples, because like when you read Srila Bhakti, how it's such a science and you know, in a way a razor's edge not to have the pure seed of bhakti. But I guess you have lots of experience, like what to do, like gurus feel if they chastise their disciple, or rather instruct them, then it might be more than they can handle, or something like that. So, I wonder, you know, like,
Did you tell your children everything you wanted to tell them?
Did I?
Mm.
No, especially now. But I don't know, they instruct me. But, like Rico Moy said, my daughters are always instructing me and telling me I'm not chanting properly, I'm not doing this properly, and I just have to accept it as my, what's the word you use, you know, that's my lot, that I have to accept that from them. But, you know, yeah, he said even though my chanting brought them into the world, they're always telling me what I'm doing wrong. But besides that, not everything, but you know what I mean, like I sometimes feel like so many devotees go away, at least in America, probably not here right now, but, you know, and I wonder, well, did the guru, like, call them up and you know, ask them, yeah, how's what happened? You know, how's it going? I haven't seen you in a long time. And by the way, I'm giving Srimad Bhagavatam class every day. Maybe you'd like to come sometime. I mean, I don't know. Like I feel that sometimes a little personal intervention might go a long way. I mean, because even us sometimes, if we just say something, somebody might start coming again, or else you hear complaints, or else I know other instances, like in our temple, the guru asked one devotee, a girl, you know, can you not wear jeans at the temple? And she got so offended, she said, well, I'm not shopping anymore, because she used to shop for the temple, well, I'm not doing it anymore if I can't wear jeans. You know, although you could wear a skirt around your jeans, so he won't say anything again. And another devotee in class, you know, he didn't say any names, but she knew that he was talking about her. And she called him up and said, if you ever do that again, I'm leaving. You know, so the gurus are up against that kind of thing. But at the same time, I feel sometimes a little bit of, you know, yeah, nudging, huh? Will go a long way.
It depends on the system, because where you have a guru who has a few disciples and is local, then that really works, and he's the one who's actually been training them, which is the regular system. Then no doubt that will happen, unless someone's really, really sort of callous. When you have a guru who's in one place but has many disciples, like, for, I wouldn't say I have many disciples, but I have, at least comparatively, but I have 500, and half of them are here and half of them are in the UK, say, roughly. It's not possible. What to speak of then? That's why I say it's those who have thousands. Then it becomes the training already was most likely mostly based on the local temple presidents, managers, shiksha gurus. So then that type of personal interaction generally will end up falling on them, just because there'll be a limit as to what a person can actually do. So it's a matter of expectations. And then if you have gurus who are traveling, who are not in one place, then it becomes even more of a more of a probability that they're not going to do that. It's even questionable whether they'll even know that that's going on. They may not even know. That's why I don't like the concept of spiritual masters just traveling too widely and not being directly involved in the disciples, because that then may happen. So for the Vaishnavas that I know who act in the capacity of spiritual master, I don't know anyone who wouldn't do that. Whether they can do it or not, or they know that it's going on, that's something else. It's very rare that Vaishnava will just sort of write someone off and say, well, I don't care, I'm not going to do anything. But it was like when Shambhihari phoned up my urologist one morning at 6 a.m., I don't know why he phoned him up at 6 a.m., but and he answered the phone, which was quite amazing. And, Shambhihari told him whatever the problem was, but then his reply was, but I got a life too. He's a man with two children. And gurus are also people. And they also have their limits. So, there was a study in the U.S. What's the main cause of divorce? And the result was over expectations from each other. So, it's a question of what the expectation is, what should really be clear. I mean, in one part of the example that you gave, you know, the guru, where the guru's able to have that type of relationship, that he's going to be able to supervise, oversee, and then care to that level with each disciple. That may not be a fair expectation, or if that's what you expect, then don't accept the traveling guru. Then you better accept someone who's very local, who you know, and who you already have that type of relationship with. Don't expect it from someone who's got thousands or tens of thousands of disciples, who's traveling all over the world. And being guru is just one of the things that he's doing. He may be a GBC, a sannyasi, a temple president. He's got other services as well. So it's the issue of expectation, and that's why gurus and disciples need to really examine each other before they make a commitment to each other that, is this actually what I really need? Because afterwards, then it's too late. And that's why Prabhupada said, should accept the person who's nearest. The tradition is, whoever is the Shiksha Guru generally becomes the Diksha Guru. Because a lot of these issues can be served. And as far as telling people, you know, what they can hear, that's a Prabhupada dealt like that. He knew there were some disciples like Tamal Krishna Maharaj who, you know, he could say anything to. But there were others who Prabhupada dealt with in a different way, because he knew they couldn't take it. And then they would. So the idea is, you need to be patient and let people's faith build up. And when they build up, then they'll be able to handle more. And I guess it's like that also in raising children. They have the people. Everyone's got their sort of limits. And you need to elevate people within their limits. Since the whole idea is to surrender, then it's hard to expect everyone to be completely surrendered, but rather as surrendered as they are, that's as much as you can expect of someone. Guru is. emphasis on, and perhaps that's also included in the way how Shiksha Gurus are, Diksha Gurus are chosen, how they're so-called, at least authorized, or use the word, no objection is given in ISKCON, whereas temple presidents, senior devotees, Shiksha Gurus don't go through that type of vetting process, and indirectly it means that they're not so qualified. It really contributes to a misunderstanding of Guru Tattva, and really puts devotees on a thin footing, because it's like a family. I mean, you can't just love your father and not love your mother and your grandmother and your grandfather and your uncles. Otherwise, you're really going to be isolated. You can't be the only person you listen to, or your mother. Or it's an overall affair, and that's what Bhagavatam's about. Vyasadeva starts talking about what Shukadeva Goswami is talking to Parikshit Maharaj, talking about Vidura and Maitreya, and Krishna and Uddhava, and so many exchanges, and we're about Bhagavad Parampara. Bhagavad Parampara basically means Sadhu Sangha, and your guru really means the person who you hear from, and the person who reveals Krishna to you, not necessarily the person who gives you initiation, as in the case of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, for instance, or even Srila Prabhupada didn't think much of his formal diksha, but his real diksha was of Bhaktisanta Saraswati Thakur. So that's and that tradition's getting really ingrained. That if you're, that there's some kind of implicit understanding in the minds of people that if you're a Diksha Guru, then you're automatically on a certain level of Krishna consciousness. That you're a liberated soul just because you're a Diksha Guru, which isn't true. And that if you're not a Diksha Guru, then you're not worth listening to, sort of means that you're not necessarily advanced, otherwise why aren't you giving initiation? And that type of, I'm not saying everybody's like that, but it's certainly a prevalent atmosphere. But that type of quality, Nato Chanish Bhakti Ishu, is the characteristic of Kanishtha Bhakta. You can't really recognize who real devotees are. And it's also limiting the functionality of ISKCON. It means devotees who are not getting due respect that they should be getting, which may also be offensive under circumstances. And then it leads to things like, all right, my Diksha Guru is the only person I listen to, but if my Diksha Guru happens to be on the other side of the world, and he's not able to respond to me on email because he's got 2,000 mails in his email box, and by the time he gets to me, I'll have turned sour because I haven't heard from him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so real respect and appreciation for Vaishnavas is really at the heart of Krishna consciousness. Lord Chaitanya didn't give initiation to anyone. Rupa Goswami only had one initiated disciple. That didn't make them any less. Didn't make them any less in the eyes of their followers, and certainly not at devotees at that time. So somehow or other, these expectations really need to be brought down to earth a little. And devotees really able to appreciate Vaishnavas for what they are in terms of their Krishna consciousness, to measure Krishna consciousness, not some other type of artificial or just some designation. Anyone can be a Diksha Guru.
Even though he's the guru of all the Acharyas, isn't he? You know.
Shukadeva Goswami, who did he initiate? He didn't initiate anybody.